This morning class deals with an instance very similar to the previous instances where Lord Indra, you remember Lord Indra became bewildered and attacked Vrindavan. And on another occasion, Lord Brahma became bewildered and attacked or tried to steal all of Krishna's friends. So in this chapter, Lord Shiva confronts Lord Krishna, but not so much out of bewilderment, but out of his promise, keeping his promise to his devotee. So we'll discuss that more, but the story is very beautiful. Chapter 19, Shiva. Bana brags to Shiva. Said Vishnu Rata, Aniruddha somehow wed a girl and caused a war with Shiva, almost burning up the world. Her father, Banasura, Bali's son, could he not see arresting Krishna's grandson would conclude his vanity? Although his father once presented Krishna with the earth, this Bana was a devotee of Shiva from his birth. He used his 1,000 arms to beat a drum as Shiva danced, and Shiva gave his blessings, making Bana quite advanced. The gods themselves were serving Bana. Shiva took the task of giving Bana's city the protection Bana asked. Puffed up with power, Bana one day meekly laid his head at Shiva's lotus feet, and being falsely humble said, I bow to you, controller of the worlds. You are the tree fulfilling every wish of your aspiring devotee. The 1,000 arms you've given me are just a useless weight because, my lord, I want to fight some worthy candidate. Aside from you, no one at all can give me a good fight. The elephants who rule the four directions all took flight when I stepped up and challenged them, for in my battle lust I'd smash the mountains on the way to heaps of stone and dust. When Shiva heard these haughty words, he angrily replied, When you confront my equal, he shall devastate your pride. The foolish Banasura was delighted by this news, for he imagined anyone he fought was sure to lose. Usha and Aniruddha. At that time, Bana's daughter, Usha, resting with some friends, experienced the kind of dream in which the dreamer spends an amorous few hours in a lover's warm embrace. Her lover was a stranger, though she clearly saw his face. The young man's face then disappeared, and Usha, in distress, cried, Where are you, my lover? As she came to consciousness. Her girlfriend sat around her as she rose, disturbed and stunned, exceedingly embarrassed about what she had just done. Her dear friend Chitraleka confidentially inquired, You've just been dreaming, lovely friend. Who is it you desire? You've never had a lover. Men have never known your touch. Who is this unseen man you seem to hunger for so much? Said Usha, I embraced a dark blue man of mighty arms, with yellow garments, lotus eyes, and every manly charm. He made me taste his honeyed lips, and then he went away, upsetting me and leaving me to long for him this way. Said Chitraleka, I shall find this man who stole your heart, if he is in this universe, by use of mystic art. I know the face of every person, demigod or man, so I shall quickly draw each one. Select him if you can. The mystic Chitraleka sketched a clear and perfect face of every male on every planet found in outer space. No sketch appealed to Usha till Pradyumna's made her blush. Then Aniruddha's startled her. It's him! It's him! She gushed. So Chitraleka, blessed with Yogamaya's strength, it seems, flew through a mystic skyway to complete her helpful scheme. When she arrived at Dwarka, security was tight, so Narada assisted her in getting in that night. She sought out Aniruddha, sound asleep upon his bed. Again, her mystic yoga power served her in good stead. She took the sleeping grandson of the Lord across the sea, where he awoke to find himself in Usha's company. When Usha recognized her love, her face lit up with joy. They slipped into the women's private rooms no man or boy had ever seen at any time. Alone with him at last, she worshipped, served, and pleased her man as days and weeks flew past. presenting priceless garments, scents, fine beverages, and food, the Princess Usha kept up Aniruddha's happy mood. Concealed within the women's rooms, he did not seek release, for Usha's love for him appeared to endlessly increase. In time, the female guards began to notice Usha's waist expanding in a way no maidens could if she were chaste. Deciding it was better to directly tell their boss, they said to Bana, "Somehow Usha's maidenhood is lost. We watched her very carefully and never left our posts. How could a man corrupt her, as is clearly diagnosed? Unless her friends, O master, played some trick we can't recall, no man has ever seen your girl within these palace walls." The frantic Banasura rushed to Usha's private room and saw the Yadu family's pride, her unofficial groom. The handsome Aniruddha sat with Usha, playing dice, as if it were a normal scene you wouldn't think of twice. He looked like Cupid's very son, so sweeping were his charms, with dark complexion, lotus eyes, and formidable arms. A fragrant jasmine garland hung on Aniruddha's chest, turned crimson by the kumkum powder gracing Usha's breasts. The angry Banasura, who had brought a score of guards, directed them to tackle Aniruddha fast and hard. Pradyumna's son stood resolute and raised his iron club, and soon the frightened guards ran off in pain and drenched with blood. The mighty son of Bali shattered Aniruddha's hopes by seizing him and binding him by use of mystic ropes. When Usha saw her lover's plight, she crumpled up and wept, not knowing this was Krishna's plan and what would happen next. Shiva battles Lord Krishna. When Aniruddha vanished, all his relatives had grieved. The monsoon season came and went. No message was received. At last sagacious Narada informed the family that Bali's son held Aniruddha in captivity. With Balaram and Krishna in the lead, the Yadus rushed, surrounding Banu's city in a mood to maul and crush. The mighty Bana fumed to see the siege upon his home and came out with an equally large army of his own. Lord Shiva led the counter-charge, his mission to protect the city of his devotee in every respect. His carrier, named Nandi, was a bull of awesome size. His son, named Kartikeya, was prepared to pulverize. Pradyumna challenged Kartikeya to a vicious fight, and Shiva challenged Krishna with astonishing delight. Lord Shiva was bewildered, as Brahma one day had been, when he made off with Krishna's friends and hid them in his den. Brahma and many other gods, their godly planes in flight, descended from the heavens to observe this shocking fight. They watched Lord Krishna's pointed arrows quickly drive away the many ghosts and demons on Lord Shiva's side that day. As Shiva started firing every weapon he could get, Lord Krishna counteracted every one with great effect. His rain attack Lord Shiva's fire weapon. His rain attack left Shiva's fire weapon limp and drawn. He then released a weapon that made Shiva sit and yawn. With Shiva incapacitated, Krishna turned the fight to Banasura's frightened troops, who scattered left and right. Pradyumna poured persistent arrows down on Shiva's son, till Kartikeya joined his fellow soldiers on the run. Lord Balaram destroyed his foes. The fight became a rout, as Banasura, furious, charged Krishna with a shout. Excited by the fighting, with his thousand arms in rows, the fearsome Bana pulled and aimed 500 deadly bows. Lord Krishna's arrow split each bow, and Bana's driver fell. The demon heard Lord Krishna's conch shell bidding him farewell. Then Bana's mother, out of her desire to save her son, appeared before Lord Krishna nude, her shiny hair undone. When Krishna turned his head away, like any gracious man, the frightened Bana saw his chance. He quickly turned and ran. Shivajwara surrenders. Just one remaining enemy persisted in the fight, the Shivajwara, Shiva's weapon, burning left and right. When Krishna saw this blaze personified resist defeat, he launched his Vishnujwara to offset its deadly heat. When Vishnujwara froze him, Shivajwara cried in pain. With no escape in sight, he turned to Krishna and exclaimed, I bow before you of unlimited might, the cause of creation, its morning and night. You're perfectly peaceful. Indeed, you imbibe the absolute truth that the Vedas describe. As seeds turn to plants, so the soul takes a form to ceaselessly suffer his fate and perform material deeds his illusions impose, a cycle of pain only you can oppose. Because of the demons who have no restraint, you come to this world to watch over the saints. Unless one finds refuge in your lotus feet, like me, he will suffer distress and defeat. Lord Krishna said, O Shivajwara, all you say is true. Have no fear of my weapon. Henceforth, no one shall fear you. The Shivajwara bowed his head and took Lord Krishna's leave, but Banasura wanted war and ended the reprieve. Shiva saves Banasura. His thousand arms crammed full with weapons, Bana charged the Lord and fired countless arrows as he furiously roared. As Bana hurled weapons, Krishna's chakra, spinning free, began to slice off Bana's arms like branches from a tree. So Shiva, seeing Bana's death was all but guaranteed, approached the Lord to try to save his foolish devotee. O absolute truth, you're as pure as the sky. The moon is your mind and the sun is your eye. The seas are your abdomen, earth is your stride. Brahma is your wisdom and I am your pride. We gods all depend on your power and grace to care for the systems of planets and space. Descending to earth for the decent and just, you benefit suffering souls such as us. Original person, transcendent, complete, no one need create you, no one can compete. Distorted by matter, our senses perceive your presence in various ways we conceive. The clouds cloak the sun when observed from the ground. As matter obstructs you, to souls who fall down. You nonetheless light up this world of distress and give what good qualities souls may possess. My family shall save me, bewildered men think. They swim in an illusion and usually sink. The pitiful human who sullies your feet discovers it's only himself that he cheats. If one enjoys matter and sets you aside, he throws away life and accepts suicide. Brahma, other gods, famous sages, and we surrender ourselves to you wholeheartedly. You fashion, maintain, and destroy everything. Befriend us and free us from all suffering. Since Bana has pleased me, O merciful God, save him as you did his ancestor, Prahlad. Lord Krishna, gently smiling, said, Lord Shiva, I agree. I certainly will do whatever you have asked of me. Prahlad received my promise his descendants would endure, so I will spare this demon Banasura, rest assured. His arms are gone, so Bana's hefty ego will abate. His army's gone, for it has burdened earth with all its weight. This Bana, though, shall serve you well with four remaining arms, and he shall never age or die. I promise him no harm. Aniruddha released. The demon Banasura bowed to Krishna, head to ground, and ordered that the grandson of Lord Krishna be unbound. A splendid chariot brought Aniruddha and his bride directly up to Krishna for a festive homeward ride. The party entered Dwarka amid the sound of drums. The royalty, the priests, and common people all had come. The welcome for Lord Krishna and his grandson was complete with lavish arches, flags, and water sprinkled in the streets. Whoever rises early, well before the break of day, and reads, recalls, or speaks of the incomparable way Lord Krishna overcame Lord Shiva, thereafter shall meet with unremitting victory and never taste defeat. Palashruti. Chapter 20. King Riga. While in the woods of Dwarka, some Yadu boys one day sought out some means to quench the thirst inflicted by their play. On peering down a nearby well, they found, to their surprise, a huge, repulsive lizard staring back with slotted eyes. The boys felt sorry for the lizard. Scurrying about, they brought some ropes and leather thongs and tried to lift it out. When all their efforts failed, they knew exactly what to do. They ran to Krishna, breathlessly disclosing all the news. The lotus-eyed Lord Krishna went directly to the well. As he reached down to lift the beast, it seemed to break a spell. At Krishna's touch, the lizard shed its cold reptilian skin and, rising, took the golden form of heaven's denizens. Though Krishna understood the situation, he inquired, "Dear sir, are you a god? What sin could possibly require an elevated soul like you to take a lizard's form? If you are up to telling us, we'd like to be informed." Requested by the limitless Lord Krishna to explain, the god bowed low and spoke of how he came to be restrained. "Though you know everything, my lord, I'll tell my tale. You see, I was the king named Riga, famed for giving charity. I gave the Brahmins lovely cows in limitless supply, as many cows as grains of sand or planets in the sky. Each cow was youthful, well-behaved, and full of luscious milk, with gilded horns and hooves and dressed in ornamental silks. Was sacrificed to augment my philanthropic pursuits, I gave those cows and other gifts to Brahmins of repute. Each one received an elephant, a chariot, a house, plus silver, gold, and gems in quantities to please his spouse. Amid these generous offerings, a solitary cow belonging to a Brahmin wandered in my herd somehow. Not knowing this had happened, I decided to present that very cow to someone else, and that caused my descent. The Brahmin who possessed the cow protested, 'She is mine.' The Brahmin now receiving her was equally inclined to keep the cow himself. 'The king gave her to me,' he said. They brought this hot dispute to me when it came to a head. 'You just gave me this cow,' the second Brahmin priest began. 'But you stole her from me,' the first replied in reprimand. The fearsome situation then became quite clear to me, so I presented both these honored Brahmins with this plea: 'If you'll return this cow, which brings disaster on my head, I'll give you each 100,000 cows right now instead. My fault was unintentional. I only meant you well, but if I don't correct it now, I'll surely go to hell.' Alas, both Brahmins wouldn't budge, and I could not conclude the conflict with more charity. In very angry moods, they left the palace feeling cheated. I now held the sin of giving gifts to Brahmins and then claiming them again. The agents of King Yamaraj took me, when I expired, before their fearsome master, who observed me and inquired, 'Your pious deeds are many, yet you also have been cursed. Your good results or bad results, which one do you want first?' I said, 'My lord, I'll take my sinful karma first of all.' At that, the mighty Yamaraj commanded, 'Let him fall.' And as I fell, I saw my human body fade away and turn into the lizard form you came across today. My dear Lord Krishna, I had been a charitable king, devoted to the Brahmins and supplying everything. Recalling these past incidents is possible to do because I also coveted an audience with you. O Lord, I must be seeing you by special circumstance, for only yogis, finished with this world, receive the chance. Govinda, God of gods, O Lord of all, be pleased with me. Allow me to recall your lotus feet incessantly. All souls originate in you, the goal of every path. You never change, although you act on everyone's behalf. To see you makes me blessed, for my distress is now relieved. Accept my deep respects, dear Lord, before I take your leave." King Riga walked around the Lord, and, falling to the ground, he touched Lord Krishna's lotus feet with his resplendent crown. A fine celestial airplane then appeared, as all looked on. With Krishna's nod, this newborn god climbed on it and was gone. Because King Riga boasted of his generosity, his pure devotion to the Lord was in its infancy. His meeting with the Lord was premature to some extent, but Krishna, for a higher cause, explain the whole event. To steal from Brahmins. To take a Brahmin's property, however it's procured, amounts to taking poison for which no one has a cure. Why, even mystic yogis who can do most anything cannot enjoy such property, and what of worldly kings? When ordinary fire burns, mere water puts it out. However, if one takes a thing possessed by the devout, he starts a different kind of blaze, so dreadful and acute, It burns the thief's entire family right down to the root. To steal a Brahmin's property will send one straight to hell along with all his children and his grandchildren as well. And taking help to do so from the government is worse, for that 10 generations back and forward shall be cursed. A member of the royal order, blinded by his wealth, sometimes usurps a Brahmin's assets, ruining himself. Such royal sinners and their loved ones cook in hell for years as numerous as specks of dust made wet by Brahmin's tears. Yet even taking back a gift will violate this, even taking back a gift will violate this rule and make the thief live 60,000 years as worms in stool. I therefore do not covet Brahmin's wealth. That grave mistake will cost a king his kingdom and then turn him to a snake. Dear friends, although he hits you or does something incorrect, be sure to always treat a learned Brahmin with respect. And even if he curses you and seems to be unkind, do not respond with harsh behavior, even in your mind. As I respect the Brahmins, so must all of you as well. If anyone refuses, I shall punish him myself. Unknowingly, King Rigam brought himself a lizard's fate. Concluding with this statement, Krishna left for his estate. Follow the same Prabhu. Okay, a quick question. So he should have had a better lawyer. Of course, this is all part of Krishna's pastime to make this point. I think Balabhasin will probably discuss that a little bit more. Yeah.
So to answer a little bit more your question is that Maharaj Nriga, he was engaged in karmakanda activities. Karmakanda activities are considered material activities. They're pious activities. They're activities which lead one to a better life in this life and in the next life. But it's not spiritual. You're not doing it to please Krishna or to engage in your constitutional position. You're doing it for some ulterior motive, some material motive. So it's described, like Mataji yesterday was saying, that these material activities are very, very specific. And that if they're transgressed, if any of the rules and regulations of karmakanda activities are transgressed, even one syllable of a mantra that's being chanted in karmakanda activities, it can completely destroy or nullify or bring the complete opposite result of what one is trying for. Whereas in devotional service is so nice that even if whatever service we perform for Krishna, for Krishna's pleasure, even if it's got some fault in it, still Krishna very kindly will accept that and overlook the defects. So devotional service is much more important, much more beneficial for the well-being of the living entity than karmakanda activities. And so because of that slight discrepancy, which Maharaj Nriga, he wasn't aware of it at all. He was doing what was the right thing. He gave the cow to the Brahmin. The Brahmin, he kept the cow. He wandered off into another Brahmin. But just because of that discrepancy of the other Brahmin taking the cow, that other Brahmin was offended. And he went to the king and he complained very, very bitterly. What is this? Why is my cow gone? And the Brahmin who he had accused of taking the cow, he also went. And Maharaj Nriga, he could understand that he had done something very wrong, very serious. And why is it that the Brahmins are so much revered? The reason that Brahmins are revered is because they're the repositories, they're the keepers, they're the speakers, they're the preachers of the Vedic knowledge. And Vedic knowledge, we understand, is what the Lord himself, with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, has given to the conditioned soul in order to become free from material existence. So it's most important, the position of the Brahmin. Brahmins have the understanding of their spiritual identity and everyone else's spiritual identity, and they're trying to encourage everyone to leave this material world and become purified. So Maharaj Niga, when he saw what had happened, you know what he did? He offered each one of the Brahmins 100,000 cows each in order that they be pacified. But because they're the upholders of religious principles, they said, no, this is not sufficient. What's happened here is very wrong. Because the Lord himself, he actually says that he eats through the mouth of the Brahmins. Without the Brahmins to maintain and protect the religious principles, everything will be lost, just like in Kali Yuga now. There's no qualified Brahmins nowadays to enunciate or to teach by example, you know, how it is that one should be in this material world. No. It was very important that they uphold the principles. And because the principle wasn't upheld, it was considered an offense. And even though it's slight, still it's so important that one not take or misuse the property of a Brahmin, like Kalakanta Prabhu was saying. For 60,000, if one does so, he will be ruined, his entire family will be ruined, and he'll have to go to hell for 60,000 years.
I was thinking that he was not at fault that the cow ran from one herd to the next. So he was not at fault. Isn't the mercy and forgiveness a higher principle than holding religious principles? So, I mean, if they are true Brahmins, then they will do what the principle will understand it. But they are not willing to understand it. And I would guess that they would also suffer because of this. Because they were unnaturally being in the first world.
Still, despite that, it's the rules of karmakanda are so exact and so specific that if they are transgressed, these are the reactions. The reactions will follow automatically. Vaishnavas are actually above the standard of a Brahmin. You know, devotees, they're actually more compassionate and more kind, more forgiving, more merciful, times a million times than any Brahmin. Prabhupada describes that a Brahmin may not necessarily be a Vaishnava, but a Vaishnava always has the highest qualities that a Brahmin could ever manifest. And the reason is because he's acting as he should be acting, which is simply for the pleasure of the Lord. Whereas the Brahmin may not be doing such. He may be in the mode of goodness, and he may be attached to elevating himself and others to the mode of goodness, or even to understanding that they're spirit, soul, Brahman understanding. But a Vaishnava is above that, because a Vaishnava only acts for the pleasure of the Lord, and only acts for the benefit of all other living entities so that they can also become free from material existence. A devotee's position is far, far, far greater than any Brahmin's position, or any sannyasi's. Is that it? So, the meaning here of Usa and Anirudh is, as it's described here in the Krishna book, it's a very mysterious and it's an interesting story. King Bali King Bali was the great devotee of Lord Vamanadev, and he had 100 sons. His eldest son was Banasura. So we understand that Bali Maharaj was a descendant of Prahlad Maharaj. And Prahlad Maharaj, we understand, was a great, great pure devotee of the Lord. And that Prahlad actually had the benediction that he and all of his descendants would get special mercy from the Lord. So this story is an exhibition of that. We understand that when the Lord engages in some particular pastime, there's many different purposes for the Lord's activities. And one of the purposes is this, is to show that the Lord's devotee and his descendants are always going to be protected, are always going to get special favor from the Lord. So this is one of the reasons why that this pastime has taken place. Bali Maharaj was a great, great, great pure devotee of the Lord, just like his forefather, Prahlad Maharaj. And even though Banasura wasn't on that exalted platform, still, because he was a descendant, you can see here that he got the Lord's special mercy. The great hero Banasura, born of Bali Maharaj, was a great devotee of Lord Shiva and was always ready to render service unto him. Because of his devotion, he achieved a great position in society, and he was honored in every respect. Actually, he was very intelligent and liberal also, and his activities are all praiseworthy, because he never, this is Banasura, because he never deviated from his promise and word of honor. He was very truthful and fixed in his vows. And in those days, he was ruling over the city of Shonatapura. So you can see that back 5,000 years ago, even the demons were considered very, they had so many good qualities. You know, unlike today. Today we see the leaders have zero, no good qualities. Lie, cheat, steal, rob from everybody that they can come in contact with. But 5,000 years ago, when we were living in a different age, before the Kali Yuga had begun, people were actually, even the demons, they were actually possessed so many good qualities. That's the reason why that the Vedic system was still intact, more or less. By the grace of Lord Shiva, Banasura had 1,000 hands, and he became so powerful that demigods like Lord Indra were serving him as most obedient servants. So we can see how powerful it is if one gets the benediction of a devotee like Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva is, we have to understand there's 33 million different demigods who are administrators of this universe. But above those 33 million demigods, they're the controlling demigods. The Lord Shiva, Lord Brahma, and Lord Vishnu. They're far, far above the ordinary demigods, far above. In fact, all of these other, every living entity in this universe that is in any position of power, they all worship, they all take shelter of usually one of these three personalities. Of course, if they're Vaishnavas, they take shelter of Lord Vishnu. But if they're demoniacally inclined, they usually take shelter of Lord Shiva, or sometimes even Lord Brahma. Just like Hiranyakashipu. Hiranyakashipu, he was a great, great demon, but what was he doing? He was taking shelter of Lord Brahma. And so because of that, he got this extraordinary benediction that he was literally able to take control of the entire universe. Banasura wasn't exactly on the same position as Hiranyakashipu, but still you can see, because he had gotten the benediction of from Lord Shiva being a pure devotee, the greatest of all devotees of Lord Narayan, of Lord Vishnu, he was given the benediction that even personalities like Indra is the head of the 33 million demigods. Indra is their chief of all the big demigods. Indra's number one. And even Indra was coming to offer respects and serve Banasura because of his very, very close association with Lord Shiva. This is important to understand how it was that Banasura, being in the family of Bali Maharaj, he got this special benediction from Lord Shiva. Long ago, when Lord Shiva was dancing in his celebrated fashion called Tandava Nritya, for which he is known as Nataraj, Banasura helped Lord Shiva in his dancing by rhythmically beating drums with his 1,000 hands. Lord Shiva is well known as Ashutosh, very easily pleased, and he is also very affectionate to his devotees. He is a great protector for persons who take shelter of him and is the master of all living entities in this material world. Being pleased with Banasura, he said, "Whatever you desire, you can have from me, because I am very much pleased with you." Banasura replied, "My dear Lord, if you please, you can remain in my city just to protect me from the hands of my enemy." So we can see that Banasura was such a great devotee of Lord Shiva that Lord Shiva actually agreed to come and reside within his city. And Lord Shiva is vastly, vastly, vastly powerful. But Banasura had him come in his city to give personal protection. But this made Banasura very, very, very proud. That's the difference. Prabhupada describes that there's two different types of living entities in this material world. He says, actually, there are two classes of men. One in Krishna consciousness, the other is non-Krishna conscious. The non-Krishna conscious men are generally devoted to the demigods, whereas the Krishna conscious men are devoted to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Krishna conscious persons utilize everything for the service of the Lord. The non-Krishna conscious persons utilize everything for sense gratification. And Banasura is a perfect example of such a person. He was very anxious to utilize his own satisfaction. For his own satisfaction, his extraordinary power to fight. So this is the problem, is that once the demoniac person gets some benediction, he immediately tries to get that benediction and utilize it for his own personal self. Whereas a devotee of the Lord, whatever it is that he gets, he immediately tries to give that as an offering unto the Lord. This is the huge difference that stands between the devotee and the non-devotee. The devotee is always acting for the benefit of the Lord, and the demon, no matter how powerful or how great his position is in the material world, he's always trying to utilize it for himself. So one day, Banasura, with this huge power that he had, he became frustrated. Over the period of time, he would go out and he would challenge people to fight with him. But because of the benediction that Lord Shiva had given him, he could beat anybody. There was no one that could challenge Banasura. So he became depressed. He started thinking, even though I'm the most powerful personality, there's no one that will stand before me. It's not enough. That's the nature of material life. The nature of material life is that no matter what benediction that we get, no matter how opulent we become, no matter how wealthy or how strong or how powerful we become, still we won't be satisfied. Why is that? The reason is because we're constitutionally created by God to be His loving servant. And only when we're situated in that loving devotional service, then and only then can we feel the satisfaction that we need, that we are created to feel. It's described that the satisfaction that a devotee derives from this loving service to the Lord is millions and billions times greater than anything that even the demigods are enjoying in the heavenly planets. So therefore, what is the chance of us becoming happy here in the material world? Zero. No matter what position we get, no matter how much opulence we get, we will always feel lacking. We will always feel like this is nowhere near enough. That's why you see in the material world, everyone is always changing their position. No matter what it is, no matter what they acquire, it's still not enough. Banasura, classic example. Number one powerful guy. Nobody can touch him. He's so frustrated with his abilities that he goes to mountains and smashes the mountains into dust. Out of sheer anxiety, out of sheer like wanting to feel satisfaction and not feeling it. So he goes to Lord Shiva, complaining to Lord Shiva, the Lord who's given him the benediction, that I cannot find anyone to satisfy my fighting ability. And immediately Lord Shiva, being the pure devotee of the Lord that he is, recognizes that this is the mentality of a demon. And he immediately chastises him. He says, "You rascal." He calls him that. I'll read it to you. Lord Shiva realized that his benediction had become troublesome from Banasura and addressed him. "You rascal, you are very eager to fight, but since you have no one to fight with, you are distressed. Although you think that there is no one in the world to oppose you except me, I say that you will eventually find such a competent person. At that time, your days will come to an end and your flag of victory will fly no longer. Then you will see your false prestige smashed to pieces." Listen to this is the demoniac mentality. After hearing Lord Shiva's statement, Banasura became very puffed up with his power. He was elated that he would meet someone with whom he would be able to smash to pieces. Banasura then returned home with great pleasure, and he always waited for the day when the suitable fighter would come to cut down his strength. He was such a foolish demon, it appears, that such foolish demoniac human beings, when unnecessarily overpowered with material opulence, want to exhibit their opulences. And such foolish people feel satisfaction when these opulences are exhausted. The idea is that they do not know how to expend their energy for right causes, being unaware of the benefit of Krishna consciousness. So then we'll move on. And then in the story, then this has transpired. And then we'll get to another part, because this is directly related to Banasura and Lord Shiva. And this is when Banasura had a very beautiful daughter, very beautiful, named Usha. And Usha was, one night she took rest, and as she took rest, she had a very, very vivid dream of this extraordinarily beautiful, beautiful, qualified person who came and embraced her and showed very much affection towards her. And when she woke up in the morning, she was very distressed. And she was thinking, "I want to be with this person." And so she had a very close girlfriend who was living with her in the palace that Banasura had built for them. And her name was Chitralekha. Chitralekha was who? She was the daughter of the prime minister of Banasura. So she had a very much exalted position. And she could see the distress that Usha was in. And like like Prabhu was saying, she had the she was a very, very great yogini, it's described. She was so great that she had access to every, practically every living entity in the planet. She could actually see everyone that there was in the planet. So she sat down and she said, I'll help you. I'll write down, I'll show you the faces. She'd start to draw the face of every single different type of living entity in the universe. And Usha was not satisfied because this was not the person she saw in a dream. Until finally, she drew the people that were here on this planet, the human beings. And one of them was Pradyumna. And Pradyumna was Aniruddha's father. So naturally, there was a very strong resemblance between the two. And she immediately began, she started to think, this is like it. This is what I saw. And then the next picture she drew was Aniruddha. It's described that at that time she blushed because she felt like, there he is. He's the one that I wanted. So Chitraleka, with her mystic powers, she was able to fly to Dwarka and take Aniruddha without his knowing and bring him back into the palace where the two were residing. What's significant in this is that we hear that these two ladies, they were living in this royal palace. And I want to read it to you just so we can hear it. It's described that the palace was so well guarded that there was no possibility of anyone being able to enter the palace. No man was actually able to even see who was in the palace. This is an important point because one of the things that makes Vedic culture, that makes it so strong and so pure, is this: the protection of the ladies, the protection of the women. Prabhupada actually gives the example that even 100 years ago, when Prabhupada's mother was here on the planet, Prabhupada describes that when his mother would go from one house to the house next door, she would get in a palanquin, a covered palanquin, so no one would be able to see her. No man would be able to see her except her husband, and she would go to that. So this is very important. That's why you see the ladies in Vedic culture. They keep their head covered. They keep their bodies covered. So in order to protect the chastity of the women, protecting the chastity of the women is foremost, it says, described. If you're a spirit soul in a lady's body, that is the number one most important principle that should be honored and should be understood. That to protect one's chastity means that you'll protect the future of the planet. If the ladies are protected and they're married properly and they're cared for properly, good progeny will ensue. And when good progeny is there, the earth will become a very, very, very nice place, a very conducive place for spiritual advancement. If, however, chastity is ignored or neglected or thought of as not being important, then immediately you run the risk of illicit sex, because then men will see unchaste women and they'll think, ah, she's available. I'll take advantage of her. And that's going on now all around. That's why the world is so terrible. The world is so terrible is because there's so many unprotected ladies who have abandoned the Vedic culture, the Vedic way of life, and now they're acting more or less like prostitutes. Whatever, if you like, you can have. That's why they dress the way that they do. That's why they act the way that they do. And the men, being lower, or as low as they, at the same equal low status, they immediately are attracted to such a thing. So to protect one's chastity, it's very important for the ladies to maintain this standard. And we could see here that 5,000 years ago, such a standard was being kept. Even in the house of a big demon like Banasura, the ladies had their own palace. They protected. They were protected. It's actually described here that, you know, the guards, what happened was, is that, you know, Aniruddha, when he came to the, when Chitraleka brought her to the palace, immediately there was connection that was there because it was something very special, something very sacred. The grandson of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You know, this is not an ordinary affair. This is something very, very mystical, very wonderful. So Aniruddha and Usha, they became intimately connected. Eventually, she became pregnant from this association. And Banasura became furious. He immediately called for the guards who were supposedly protecting her. And he, what is this? What has happened here? And they said, we didn't do anything wrong. No one has entered the palace. No one has violated the rules of chastity, which you have asked us to keep intact. But somehow or another, it's happened. Banasura immediately rushed to the room of his daughter, Usha. And Aniruddha and Usha were sitting there. They were playing some game. And Aniruddha, being the son, the grandson of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, wasn't even fazed, even slightly, by this demon Banasura's presence in front of him. He just continued on the way that he was. So immediately Banasura called for his army to come and arrest this man who was with his daughter. But because Aniruddha is an eternal associate of the Lord, he immediately was able to, he didn't have a weapon, he picked up a rod that was lying nearby, and he killed all of Banasura's soldiers. No one could challenge him. No one could take him. And he was, and because of his position as being a direct associate of the Lord. So then Banasura, he had a, because of his special connection with Lord Shiva, he had a special weapon. Does anyone know the name of that weapon? Of course you know, but what is it? Nagapasha, the snake noose. Banasura knew various arts of fighting, and by the grace of Lord Shiva, he knew how to arrest his opposing enemy by the use of Nagapasha, the snake noose. And so Aniruddha was seized as he came out of the palace. When Usha received the news that her father had arrested Aniruddha, she became overwhelmed with grief and confusion. Tears began to flow down her, began to glide down her eyes. And being unable to check herself, she began to cry very loudly. Then we know there's a couple of very important points here that need to be made. One is that whoever it is that the Supreme Personality of Godhead protects, no one can defeat him. And on the other hand, whoever it is that the Lord doesn't protect, he can easily be defeated. So that's what we have here. We have a great devotee of one of the demigods, Banasura, working on behalf of Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva working in cooperation with him. A fight ensued, because it was described that 4 months passed and still no Aniruddha had come back. So Narada Muni, being the great devotee that he is, and wanting the Lord's pastimes to be manifest, he informed the members of the Yadu dynasty what had happened. And so they got 18 Akshahini divisions, and they went to attack Shantipura, where Banasura was residing. And a huge fight took place. It's described that the fight was so intense that if one were to see it, the hairs on his body would literally stand up. Huge fight. Lord Shiva fought with Lord Krishna, and the Kartikeya fought with the commander of who did he fight? Who? Yes. Huge fight took place, and then we know about the weapon that was there. Huge fight took place, and you know, everybody was getting killed. Huge amount of bloodshed, and still. We see within the fighting that Lord Krishna was able to exhibit, you know, powers that even Lord Shiva didn't possess. He was able to cause Lord Shiva to yawn and go to sleep in the midst of the fighting. Lord Shiva had no way to counteract that. It's described that Lord Shiva had a special weapon, his personal weapon called Pashupatastra. And Krishna immediately, he counteracted it by his weapon called Narayan Shastra. And so Lord Shiva then, he was exasperated. He didn't know what to do any longer. So Lord Krishna gave this special weapon, which he threw at Lord Shiva, which caused Lord Shiva to fall asleep. Lord Shiva fell asleep, and then Lord Krishna turned his attention towards Banasura. Banasura, he was defeated by the Lord. He had a relationship with Kotara. Kotara was a demigoddess residing in the heavenly planets, who Banasura had a special relationship with as mother and son. And she came before Lord Krishna with no clothes on, and Lord, in order to teach by everyone by example and to show, says that Lord Krishna didn't like the sight of this woman, and he turned his face from her. And that gave Banasura the chance to make the escape. So he left the battlefield, went back, came back later, and he was... you know, Krishna personally dealt with him, cut off his 1,000 arms, and soundly defeated him. So, very important story, that if one is protected by Lord Krishna, victory is guaranteed 100%. Is that the number? Guaranteed 100% victory is there. And on the other hand, if we don't take shelter of the Lord or his devotees, we are guaranteed 100% defeat. So these very, very nice stories, the stories of... Well, you know, there's different. It's described that there's different kinds of marriages. You know, one of them is when you're betrothed by the family, gets together and they make arrangements. But another way is when you're kidnapped. You know, if you're kidnapped, if a chachya, she kidnapped him. And plus, it's a special pastime because of him, his being an associate of the Lord. You know, I mean, eternal. You know, he's the eternal son of the Lord. So it's an extraordinary pastime with extraordinary circumstances. Do you know that Kalakanta Prabhu? Yeah, different names, but different personalities. Like Prabhu was saying, I don't think they're Vishnu Tattvas. Yeah, I thought about the same thing. I mean, I was trying to like put it in the right perspective. Remember what Srila Prabhupada had said. One thing to understand is that whenever the Lord fights, not an ordinary person can fight with him. He has that same desire, you know, to fight that we have because we're part and parcel of him. That desire originally comes from Krishna. So Krishna, he also likes to fight. And this is an exhibition of his liking to fight. And also, Lord Shiva can be just like Lord Brahma. You know, there's a possibility that due to the Lord's direct influence, you know, he can become forgetful of what his position is in relationship to his Lord. And it appears that, it says that he came to his senses. It says that, it's described in the Krishna book, Prabhupada says that Lord Shiva, after seeing what had happened, and how no matter what he did, he couldn't, because Lord Shiva can fight everybody. Then he realized this is the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Then, like, how could she get?
That's what I'm saying. It's an extraordinary, it's a pastime. It's a transcendental pastime. It's not like an ordinary mundane pastime.
Yeah.